This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Florida Governor Rick Scott says he wants the Republican presidential nominee to be laser-focused on job creation, much as the governor himself has been in a stewardship of the Sunshine State. Scott penned an editorial in USA Today saying he's not planning to endorse any candidate before Florida's presidential primary on March 15th, but he says he understands why Donald Trump is leading in the polls. The voters, said Scott, are frustrated with where the country's headed, and Trump taps into that frustration. Like Scott was in the gubernatorial race, Trump is a political outsider ruffling establishment feathers. But is a laser focus on jobs what voters really want in their next presidential candidate? Is the economy what's going to steer voters towards one candidate over another? And if Scott's editorial wasn't an endorsement of Donald Trump, what exactly was it? Could it backfire for the Florida governor as he lays the groundwork for his post-gubernatorial career? We're taking your calls on this story. How important do you think Scott's vision of the primary is for the GOP, for the country? We're at 1-866-338-5252. And with me in the studio, Jason Garcia, Associate Editor with Florida Trend Magazine. Welcome back to Intersection, Jason.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Frank Torres, Editor of the Orlando Political Observer. Good to see you again, Frank.
Good morning.
And joining us by phone, Orlando Sentinel columnist Beth Kassab. Thanks for joining us, Beth.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
Well, here's what Rick Scott wrote about Donald Trump. I'm quoting from his USA Today editorial. Quote, I don't think his ability to give the most interesting interviews or speeches is the only thing that has him leading in the polls. I think he is capturing the frustration of many Americans after 7 years of President Obama's very intentional government takeover of the American economy. End quote. Scott goes on to say that the economy is not doing so well, thanks to the president, except for in a handful of states, including Florida. And Scott says he's not planning to endorse any candidate ahead of the Florida GOP primary in March. Jason Garcia, if this isn't an endorsement, what exactly is it?
I guess you could call it a non-endorsement endorsement. It's about as close as you can get to endorsing while claiming that you haven't actually endorsed. What it does is gives the governor an ability to walk it back a little bit a little later this year if Donald Trump implodes. But I think it's pretty safe to say that his preferred candidate is Donald Trump. That's been sort of the belief in Tallahassee for a couple of months now. Mm-hmm. He does not seem to have a very good relationship with Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio. This is Rick Scott endorsing Donald Trump in the strongest way he can without taking too much risk on himself.
Were you surprised that this came out when it did and the substance of it?
No, I think this was something that's been building for a while. It's from the governor's perspective, it's a great way to get some more attention for himself, to inject him into national politics, which everybody believes is his ultimate ambition here. Mm-hmm. The move makes a lot of sense to me.
Beth Kassab, Governor Scott isn't a typical politician, and he points that out in his editorial. He makes that claim of Donald Trump, too. But how much in common do you think he really has with Donald Trump?
Well, you know, if you read the piece that he penned for USA Today, the governor does make a good point. I mean, he and Donald Trump were both kind of these non-establishment candidates who did not have a long history in politics, who were able to swoop in and shake up the system, so to speak. And the governor in that piece, you know, he went on to list, you know, a number of governors like him. He even mentioned Chris Christie. Which maybe leaves the door open on a Christie campaign for Scott, including the governor in Kentucky who just won a few months ago, and that was kind of an outsider businessman who came and shook up that race. Mm-hmm. So it is true they have some things in common, and I think that because the governor appears to have ambitions in politics outside of the state of Florida, he may have been an outsider to begin with, but he's mm-hmm. certainly part of the establishment now. You know, he's maybe trying to ride on Trump's coattails a little bit and say, hey, I'm just like this guy, and I've got some potential on the national stage as well.
Mm-hmm. 1-866-338-5252 is the number. Is Rick Scott trying to ride on Donald Trump's coattails? What exactly is going on with this editorial here? And where do you think we'll see him on the national stage post-governorship? Frank Torres, would you expect to see other governors try and get out in front of the crowd now with similar non-endorsements, so to speak?
You know, governors are in a really careful position, especially with a character like Donald Trump. I thought it was a really bold move by Rick Scott to sort of side up with Donald Trump, who said some very controversial things over the last few months. But it also continues this strange relationship he's had with sort of the establishment Republican Party in Florida. Mm-hmm. You recall his candidate for chair wasn't elected last year, a candidate he endorsed. You know, there's rumors of him, you know, pulling away funds from the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. And it's just this strange dance that Rick Scott's always sort of dealt with in the background because he used to be an outsider. He was an outsider when he was elected in 2010. A continuation of the strange relationship he has with the establishment in the state of Florida.
Mm-hmm. Well, the governor was asked about the primary this week on Fox News. Let's hear a little bit of that. Here's Neil Cavuto.
A crucial winner-take-all state might not be won by the two favorite sons, either Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio. Does that possibility surprise you?
I think Florida is the biggest swing state in the country. I think it's going to be a national race when it gets to Florida. It's winner take all March 15th. I think it's going to be about jobs.
And Rick Scott went on to throw back to when he had that economy conference, the summit, where he invited a lot of those potential presidential candidates, kind of pivoting back to jobs there. That's what you hear. Jason Garcia, as Scott wrote in his editorial, he wants the GOP presidential candidate to be laser-focused on job creation. You hear a bit of that sort of pivot in that answer there, but is a laser focus on one issue going to be enough to win that presidential nomination, whoever the nominee may be?
No, it's not, especially with the way terrorism concerns have sort of flown to the top of the issue ladder here with San Bernardino and Paris. You cannot be a single-issue candidate and win the presidency in outside of an extraordinary circumstance. Perhaps it could happen in the first presidential election year after September 11th, for instance, or something mm-hmm. like that. But generally speaking, you have to be a lot broader. What Rick Scott, I think, is right about is you can be a successful politician or a successful candidate now by sort of speaking past the media, not engaging in direct questions and sort of speaking directly to your own partisans and using outlets like Twitter and Facebook. And I think that's sort of the lesson of Rick Scott, not that he's focused solely on jobs, but that he has successfully bypassed the traditional information filters that other candidates have had to use.
Mm-hmm. And if you're looking to draw parallels between Rick Scott and Donald Trump, Twitter is something that Trump seems pretty adept at. In fact, I think Jeb Bush made a comment not too long ago saying that Trump was Twitter drunk, quote unquote.
Yeah, that's right. Donald Trump has successfully, and it's easier for him because he's so famous and he has such a sort of a massive built-in audience. But yes, he is speaking directly to people. He's not engaging in the same way that candidates normally do with other candidates and with the media and really delving into substantive stuff. This has been going on for months. He says outlandish things or sort of just vague sort of promises, and that's the closest he is getting to policy specifics. And mm-hmm. that's because he's able to just sort of speak in rally form the whole way, and it's working so far.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you heard some of that last night in New Hampshire. So the call and response, who's going to pay for the wall? Mexico. And he made the comment
exactly.
that he hasn't done that before, but it's kind of the, he's up and he's really in that mode, and it seems to work for him, as you say. Mm-hmm. Beth Kassab, at the end of last year, the attention of most of the candidates was on national security, and as Jason mentioned, that's still top of mind. Do you think voters are looking for a candidate to turn the conversation back to the economy, back to more domestic issues?
Well, anybody who's looked at their 401k this week will probably think that's the case. I mean, and I don't suggest you do that, by the way. But, you know, look, the markets have taken a turn, and if this is setting a tone for the year, then I think there is going to be a larger focus on the economy heading into November, but the national security issue isn't going to go away. That's right. going to remain, you know, top of mind. There's mm-hmm. there's just no chance that will slip from consciousness. So, mm-hmm.
Frank Torres, what's the risk for Governor Scott, if there is one, in getting a kind of an endorsement-y sounding non-endorsement out there in print? I mean, you say that he can walk it back, but could it backfire?
You know, I don't really think it can, unless, you know, if he did decide to go all in on Trump and Trump said anything more outrageous than he's possibly said so far in this election, which would be difficult to imagine, then, yeah, it could do some harm for him. You know, he'll anger a lot of the people in the state, both Jeb Bush, who still has a large following in Tallahassee, and Marco Rubio as well. So, you know, it's a real interesting perspective where he's coming from with all this. And you'll recall in 2012, Rick Scott was a non-factor. His approval rating was, I believe, 31%. Mm-hmm. And he sort of had to hang back from the Mitt Romney campaign. He wasn't a wanted element during that presidential cycle. So now he's coming out here. You know, he has a little bit more going on his side, and, you know, and we're seeing what he can do with it.
Mm-hmm. One thing I wanted to add to that, too, is this this sort of taps into directly what is the single biggest criticism of Rick Scott you hear from other Republican politicians in Florida. As Frank mentioned, almost every mainstream Florida Republican politician is lined up, or insider of any kind is lined up with Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio.
Right.
And one of the reasons for that is, you know, a lot of people realize that having a president from Florida would be good for Florida. What Rick Scott, his model has been, his interest is in Rick Scott, not the Florida Republican Party, not building up. The single greatest criticism you hear of him right now is he is raising and spending campaign money only on his own future, on Let's Get to Work and his potential Senate campaign in a couple of years. He is not doing the blocking and tackling and the prepping Florida to carry the state for whoever the Republican nominee is. And his deciding to almost endorse Donald Trump over two sort of homegrown candidates, it sort of fits right within that dynamic.
They're calling it Rick Scott's revenge. That's what they're calling it.
Now, that's, Jason, a criticism you're hearing from GOP
legislators and fellow elected officials, yeah, and fundraisers. This is you know, the governor is seen as a guy who is of and for the governor. He's not for himself. He is not a conventional. Usually, you think of the governor of Florida or the governor of a party is the head of the state party. So, So you know, when Jeb Bush was governor, he spent an awful lot of time raising money for the Republican Party of Florida, helping other Republican candidates around the state, and the goal was to make Florida more Republican. Rick Scott's goal doesn't appear to be to make Florida more Republican, but to sort of elevate Rick Scott.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to stay with politics for a moment before we move on to a break. Jeb Bush, the one-time frontrunner of the crowded field of GOP candidates, has pulled most of his Miami staff out of South Florida and shifted them to early primary states. Is it a good move, or is it a sign of the disruptive influence of Donald Trump on this primary? Up to 60 staff is being sent to New Hampshire, Iowa, South Carolina, Nevada. The first primary is less than a month away now. And as Politico reports, the Bush campaign is searching for momentum. Jason, is this going to give Bush the momentum he needs, or is it like in the last minutes of a soccer match where everyone goes up, including the goalie, kind of in a last-ditch attempt to score a goal?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of that. It's difficult to overstate the importance of New Hampshire to Jeb Bush. It's not so much that he needs to win that state. It's, you know, sort of remarkable, but expectations have been sufficiently lowered for him that what he needs to do, though, is he can't finish behind both guys like Chris Christie and John Kasich.
Right.
He needs to finish, you know, probably top three. It looks like Donald Trump and Marco Rubio are likely the top head, but he needs to be – there can't be any other sort of candidate that can claim the establishment mantle that finishes ahead of him. Otherwise, that is going to be a very significant blow to him.
Mm-hmm. And on this program last month, former Republican Congressman Lou Fry said he thinks Bush could do okay if he wins South Carolina. Is South Carolina kind of like the last bastion for Bush?
I would hesitate to call it the last bastion because he's got so much money, and Florida is still sitting out there that he can make it to there, and you know, he should be able to run a very strong campaign there. Although it's been remarkable in the polling so far how much he has struggled even in Florida. The problem is that's far enough away that you can't continue to lose without losing a lot of momentum. That's what Rudy Giuliani, I don't know if you recall, he staked his strategy on bypassing all the early states, and Florida was going to be the one he won. But by the time Florida rolled around, he was an afterthought because he'd been such a non-factor in all the other states. So South Carolina is clearly very important to Jeb. I wouldn't call it the last bastion, but you know, it's pretty close to the last bastion.
Mm-hmm. Beth Kassab, we've talked before in this program, you know, months ago about how you were saying that Jeb Bush's strength was going to be the kind of adult in the room, so to speak, play up his record as governor, his ability to get things done. What's your sense of where this campaign might go if Bush gets knocked out?
Yeah, you know, so he's not out yet. I mean, as Jason said, he still has a lot of money. He's attempting to get organized in some of these key states. So I wouldn't say it's over. But the reality is, you know, where's this campaign going if Bush gets knocked out? I mean, it's going to look kind of the same as it does today, with a lot less money coming from the Bush campaign, because who's getting the most attention? It's Trump and Rubio and, to some extent, Ted Cruz. You know, that might not make sense to a lot of us here in Florida, but that is the case. So I don't know that Bush getting knocked out changes the big high-level dynamics of this campaign.
Mm-hmm. Frank Torres, what about Marco Rubio? He's taken some flack for being kind of a senator missing votes. Can he capitalize on Bush's plight if Bush continues to not do so well?
Yeah, as far as the establishment wing goes, if you want to call Marco Rubio establishment, it's a battle of attrition. For every blow Jeb Bush takes, it increases his chance of getting the nomination. The party does not want Donald Trump to be the nominee. And I think you're going to see some real, you know, we've heard rumors of a brokered convention, you've heard complaints from Trump and other outsiders like Ben Carson that they're not getting the respect that other candidates get from the party in that regard. So I think that, if Jeb continues to take punishment you see these other outsiders continue to flourish, you're going to see more and more elements of the party flock towards Marco Rubio to try to avoid a Donald Trump nomination or even a Ben Carson nomination, somebody who doesn't match up well with Hillary Clinton in the general election. Win in November. That's always going to be the goal, and they're going to go with whoever can get them in there.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're going to move on from politics next. Still to come, Islamophobia, or a one-off, as Titusville police arrest the suspect of a New Year mosque vandalism. How easy is it to brush off an incident like this and carry on, or does it instill real fear in a community? We're at 1-866-338-5252. Intersection returns in a minute.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Florida Hospital, presenting a new 12-story women's hospital filled with experts in preventative health, personalized maternity services, and the highest level of specialty care, all in one place. Florida Hospital for Women, because women are one of the reasons life is amazing.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Nicole Creston. Good morning. Thanks for joining us. You can take us with you anywhere you go throughout the day by downloading the WMFE mobile app. It's free for Apple and Android devices. Just search WMFE in the App Store or Google Play Store.
Support for 90.7 News comes from the Able Trust, with its partners committed to providing opportunities for successful employment to Floridians with disabilities. The Able Trust believes that including people with disabilities is part of a diverse and inclusive workforce, helping to empower Florida's economy. AbleTrust.org.
Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. On the phone, we have Beth Kassab for the Orlando Sentinel, and in the studio, Jason Garcia with Florida Trend Magazine, and Frank Torres with the Orlando Political Observer. And you can join us. We're at 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. A mosque got vandalized in Titusville on New Year. Police have a suspect in custody after footage was released of a man defacing the mosque and spreading bacon on the front step. Local civic leaders and members of the faith community reacted with shock. They say the vandalism doesn't represent the values of that community at all. But there are some Islamic groups who say it's part of a pattern of slurs that have shaken the Muslim community in the aftermath of attacks on Paris and San Bernardino here in the United States. So is there more that needs to be done to make sure Muslim residents are safe? Whose responsibility is it, other than law enforcement, to ensure mosques and other places of worship aren't the target of hateful symbols, vandalism, or worse? We're at 1-866-338-5252. Well, here's a little bit of sound from the mayor of Titusville, Jim Tully, talking to WMFE with his reaction to that mosque vandalism.
Oh, it was clearly an outlier. You know, there are always bigots around, and fortunately, they're few and far between. And that the gentleman that I shouldn't even call him a gentleman, the rogue that did that was not typical of anyone in Titusville. I mean, we've got my kids went to school with kids from Muslim families. I have friends who are Muslim, and this community respects all religions. And I was amazed that it happened to begin with, but it's not the kind of thing that any of us would expect to happen in Titusville. And I can assure you that the man that did that will be prosecuted.
Well, Beth Kassab, Mayor Jim Tully calls this alleged perpetrator an outlier, but there have been other incidents across the state and around the country in recent months. What surprises you about these incidents and the response by the Islamic community and law enforcement? I mean, should there be a response from the larger faith community here?
Well, unfortunately, I'm not surprised by these incidents. There have been some of these around Florida and other states, especially since the attacks in Paris and San Bernardino. You know, I understand what Mayor Tully is saying. He's saying, hey, this is not indicative of Titusville as a community, and I would agree with that. But I think the point here is that, you know, this could happen anywhere. And, you know, I think the response by the Islamic community has been really measured and really on point. They seem to be very much focusing on safety, but also, you know, instilling a sense of calm. So, as far as law enforcement goes, the response in this case seemed pretty appropriate. And as the mayor said, you know, this man will be prosecuted.
Mm-hmm. Here's the question, though. Can you enforce tolerance? Can you make a community more tolerant by arresting people, locking them up?
So, no, I mean, you cannot enforce tolerance. You know, you can't enforce how people feel and these kind of visceral and what I would consider to be irrational reactions, like what we saw in this case in Titusville. But what you can do is say when that happens, the person will be, there will be an investigation, the person will be prosecuted, that the local community will not accept it. So.
Mm-hmm. Frank Torres, some politicians are kind of blaming each other for stoking the fears of residents in the wake of international and domestic terrorism. Should politicians take some of the blame for backlash against Muslims here in the United States?
By politicians, do you mean Donald Trump? I mean, it really does swing right back around to his comments about his potential or his proposal to ban Muslim travel to the United States. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really all stemmed from that. I think, you know, each Republican or each politician has to take a certain accountability for what they've said. And if they choose to wade into those waters, which they're really outside of the national stage, there really shouldn't be a reason for them to do, then they should be responsible for any, you know, backlash that comes from their remarks. Mm-hmm. It's a very emotional issue, a very controversial issue, and one that, you know, most lawmakers shouldn't have to deal with, especially on a municipal level, where, you know, they should be more concerned about public safety and transportation. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it all comes down to the individual politicians' actions over whether they should take accountability for their actions or not.
Mm-hmm. We're going to move on now from that story. Move on to something else, a story about mental health funding in Florida, or the lack thereof. Now, a campaign launched this week highlighting Florida's lack of mental health funding. The hashtag ElectHealthFL campaign calls on Floridians to contact elected officials and ask for more funding. Florida either ranks near the last among 50 states in per-person mental health funding at $37 per head. Florida spends one-third of what, say, Mississippi spends and a tenth of what Maine puts into mental health. Is calling elected officials the best way to go about boosting that funding level, though? How important an issue is it? We're at 1-866-338-5252. Frank Torres, last year Governor Scott signed an executive order aimed at better coordination for mental health services in Florida. Now, the governor said at that time mental health funding is too fragmented and the state has to get better at delivering care. Is there an appetite among lawmakers for channeling some funding towards mental health care?
You know, I believe there is. I think, you know, Scott's proposal rallied around, you know, getting mental health for people in younger ages, you know, from children to teenagers, to try to, you know, really tackle these problems early on before these potentially mentally ill people grow up and do real damage. And it ultimately goes to the gun control conversation where, you know, these people are mentally disturbed and have been, you know, have resulted in mass shootings that have hurt innocent people. So I think there is an appetite from the public for this mental health care to try to, you know, prevent any further tragedies and to prevent the destruction of any more families.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we heard President Obama call this week for better access to mental health care. As you say, Frank, in the context of gun control, that was the speech he was making. Obama is proposing, quote, a new $500 million investment to help engage individuals with serious mental illness and care, improve access to care by increasing service capacity and the behavioral health workforce, and ensure that behavioral health care systems work for everyone. End quote. How does a statewide call for better mental health funding fit into that, though? Will lawmakers push back? You know, this is largely Republican legislature. Will they push back because it comes on the heels of an executive order from the president?
Well, you know, it's whenever you inject the president into it, then all of a sudden, you know, it becomes a partisan issue. And and all the lawmakers go to their respective parties for their platforms. So, but this is a very emotional issue and an issue that takes lives. So you're going to continue to see your lawmakers that are against these orders or these actions by the president fall to their side, and organizations like the NRA oppose these actions and these measures, and you're going to continue to see the president's base and his supporters rally to his side and try to move these initiatives forward. But just given the recent string of events over the past couple of years that stem all the way up from Columbine up to Sandy Hook from the recent years ago, everybody agrees that there does need to be some actions need to be taken. Mm-hmm. It's just a difference over what avenues to take.
Mm-hmm. 1-866-338-5252. What are your thoughts on mental health care funding? Who should take the lead here? Is it the states or is it the federal government taking responsibility? 1-866-338-5252. Jason Garcia, how does the statewide call for better mental health care funding fit in with the governor's drive to cut taxes and generally slim down the state government? I mean, health care, whether it's mental health, any other kind of health, it's not cheap.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think what you just put your finger on what's going to be one of the bigger issues this session. I think mental health is going to be something that gets a lot of attention this legislative session, and it has the potential to be one of those flashpoints that'll emerge before the end. And that's because there's going to be a push to really increase mental health funding, particularly out of the Senate, and that's going to run headlong into the governor's push to claim $1 billion in tax cuts and throw $250 million into business incentives. Mm-hmm. Those things are going to be weighed against each other, and I think you'll see a lot of tension over that in that debate as the state moves into the budget process later this session.
Mm-hmm. What's your sense of how much attention Floridians are paying to mental health care and how it's funded? I mean, obviously when the president makes a speech, people are going to perk their ears up and pay attention. But in general, is this an issue that's on the front burner for most Floridians?
I don't know if I would say it's the front burner, but I think it is. It has gained significantly in terms of the amount of attention it's getting from people. These horrific shootings that are happening has generated a lot of attention, and you're seeing major media outlets are paying more attention. The Tampa Bay Times and the Sarasota Herald Tribune did a wonderful investigation earlier this year, looking into sort of how unsafe mental health facilities are in Florida, and right, largely because of a lack of resources. So I think people are paying a lot more attention to this than they have in the past, and I think you're going to see that reflected in this legislative session.
Mm-hmm. Frank Torres, a call for people to contact their legislators is well-intentioned, but how much of an impact can a campaign like that have on what legislators do or don't do in this session?
It all depends on the makeup of the legislature's district. If they're more of a if they're in a more conservative district, a more right-leaning district, then they're going to they're going to oppose any sort of actions that would keep them from accessing the potential sale from buying firearms. And if they're in a left-leaning district, they're going to be on the other side. So as far as each individual legislator and their stance on how it affect them, it really depends on the mood of their constituency over whether it will affect what their actions are. I think we're going to see a lot of the lawmakers stick to party lines on this, and you're going to see heavy pushes from both sides to try to get the momentum to swing their way. Given the makeup of the legislature, I think any sort of gun legislation with the president's signature or accent on it faces a very tough road in Tallahassee.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. The other thing is, obviously Governor Scott is paying attention with that executive order last year, better coordination there. Lawmakers, though, there's that sort of tenuous relationship between the lawmakers right up there and the governor. So how does that all fit together? Because if the governor wants to get something done, it's not necessarily to say that is going to happen.
I think, and I think Jason could probably attest to this too, the governor – this year, the governor's going to be about his tax cuts. He's going to want his agenda to move forward. And, we talked about the direction he's moved in earlier in the show. If something's got to get passed up or missed on for him to get what he needs, then he's going to do it. And I don't think anything's off the table as far as that regards. It adds an interesting dimension of drama when you throw in the way he's accustomed to getting things done.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to take a call now. We've got Robert calling from Orlando. Robert, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi, I would like to approach this topic of gun violence and mental illness from two aspects. Mm-hmm. First, we were speaking earlier, you mentioned that Rick Scott has said he wants to make progress towards improving mental illness or mental health in the state. However, let's remember that last year he significantly cut budgets, millions of dollars, towards local service, local community service programs that would help the mentally ill. So it's kind of a, yes, I want to do this. However, don't look at my voting record. The second thing I want to approach is how we frame the conversation about gun violence and the mentally ill. I think it's important to realize that despite the fact that we have 31,000 deaths by guns in the country per year, almost two-thirds of those deaths are actually by suicide. So if we're going to frame the conversation about guns and the impact that they're having on society and the way that the mentally ill are using them, I think we should approach it more from how do we prevent the number of suicides rather than just blaming the mentally ill for the mass number, for the number of mass shootings in this country. I think it does more damage to frame that in a negative. Well, we should we should prevent the mentally ill from having guns because they kill lots of people. I think that that does more damage than saying we should help the mentally ill so they don't use guns to inevitably kill themselves, which is what the statistics are showing. Instead of how it can sometimes be framed.
Robert, thank you so much for your call. I do appreciate you weighing in there. Frank, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I was going to answer Robert's question. I think suicidal tendencies as well as violence towards lashing out both fall under that mental health umbrella. It's an interesting – the statistics are there. And, of course, you know, gun violence, whether it's self-inflicted or inflicted or each other against others, does make a difference. But, I mean – as far as the suicide angle goes, it really does come down to mental health. These people that have experienced difficulties in their life are going to lash out. And whether it's against each other, against other people, or against themselves, it definitely does have to be addressed.
The caller did make the point, though, about sort of cutting funding for some of the safety net services. And Jason, there are two things going on here. There's kind of trying to slim things down, get tax cuts passed, make sure it's a like kind of lean, mean government. But sometimes you got to spend a bit of money to get to these complex issues solved.
That's exactly right. Those two issues are not at all unrelated. Florida, one of its overarching policy choices of the last 15 years has been to consistently reduce taxes and make it an ever lower tax state. And that's great in a lot of ways. It makes the state a lot of, attractive to people in some ways. But it's also bad in that you end up cutting away at significant government services, and that's one of the key reasons mental health funding in Florida is so poor. And I think my expectation is you're seeing a bit of a rebound on this issue right now, where there will be a push from within the legislature to restore some of that funding in this area. Like Frank said, that's going to run headlong into the governor's push for tax cuts and business incentives. So the one of the central tensions of the next couple of months will be how do you sort of balance those two things.
And of course, mental health funding isn't the only aspect of where people are saying, look, we've got to put some more money into this. There's a bunch of different places where people are saying we just need some more money sort of injected into these issues so we can fix them. It's not just health, it's a bunch of other things too. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're going to move on to education, talk about that after the break. The latest in the debate over testing the State Board of Education, approving new rules on how to score the Florida Standards Assessment Test, the FSA. It's going to make it tougher to pass the exam. And, of course, testing is a bit of a hot-button issue. Not everybody in favour of the amount of testing we have here in Florida. We'll be taking your calls, 1-866-338-5252, when Intersection returns.
Support for 90.7 News comes from OUC, the Reliable One, featuring the faces behind the Reliable One. OUC employees, performing more than 20,000 tests to ensure clean water and delivering nearly 28 billion gallons of water annually. More about the faces behind the Reliable One at OUC.com.
Good morning, I'm Nicole Creston, and you're listening to Intersection. In your forecast, a mix of sun and clouds today, with highs reaching the upper 70s to around 80 degrees and scattered showers expected, lows in the lower 60s overnight. For the weekend afternoon, highs are forecast to hit the 80-degree mark on Saturday, with lows in the mid-60s, cooler on Sunday.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Polk Museum of Art in Lakeland, welcoming two new exhibitions featuring artists in their first U.S. museum shows, Forever Young, a retrospective of works by international pop artist Russell Young, and Matters Make Space by Japanese-American artist Michiko Fuji Fowler. PolkMuseumOfArt.org.
Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. With me in the studio, Frank Torres with the Orlando Political Observer and Jason Garcia with Florida Trend Magazine. And joining us by phone, Beth Cassid with the Orlando Sentinel. And, of course, our phone lines are open. We're taking your calls at 1-866-338-5252. We're going to talk about education and the latest in the debate over testing, the Florida Standards Assessment Test. The State Board of Education approved new rules on how to score that test. It's going to make it tougher to pass the exam. And the Orlando Sentinel reports 40% or more students could fail most of the language, arts and math exams this spring, but the new rules aren't as tough as some were calling for. The aim is to make more students ready for jobs once they graduate, so it should keep the employers happy, but some parents are already opposed to the regimen of tests that students have to take, and they're not happy with it. Is the school board on the right track by toughening up those tests, or have they got it wrong? 1-866-338-5252. Beth Cassib, what difference do you see this making to the debate raging over whether there's too much testing for school kids?
Well, the vote that the board took on Wednesday is largely a status quo vote. We expect the number of A schools and F schools to remain pretty much the same, and the test, you know, the amount of kids failing is will be about the same as well. There are some bigger pushes, though, that could make a difference. You know, we've got a story on OrlandoSentinel.com right now. Senator Don Gates is proposing some legislation that would allow school districts to vote independently and do away with the state test, known as the FSA, altogether, and use instead the SAT or the ACT or the ACT, or for younger kids, components of those tests that we often think of as high school tests. So that could make a big difference, and I think that that is worth watching, because what a lot of folks fail to remember in all of the hyperbole over testing is that the point of this system is to allow parents, teachers, administrators, whoever, look at schools and compare them against each other and see where some are not working. So if we have this patchwork of different tests, that could impede that process a little bit. Now, it's not to say it couldn't be done. I think Seminole County, which was on the forefront of trying to use the ACT and SAT last year, I think they make a good case, and I think there's a way to work it out. But, you know, I think that, you know, what parents really need to be concerned about is accountability, you know, still going to work.
What about the issue of whether the tests are really doing enough to test the students? Because, you know, some business leaders are saying the tests aren't tough enough. And kids aren't getting the skills they need. Once they get out into the real world, they realize it's a cold, hard world out there, and what they learned in school might not be enough to get them the jobs they need. Do they have a point?
Oh, they do. They do have a point. Because in a lot of states, the high school diploma isn't really worth much. And this whole push has been to make the high school diploma really mean something, you know, not just be this, you know, low level measures have been met and certain boxes have been checked, but the high school diploma should mean you are ready for college, or you're ready for a career, or you're ready for some other training, you know, whatever the student might be interested in. And high school diplomas don't really mean that today, and that's a problem. So that's where business leaders are saying, you know, we need to make the diploma mean something more. The state board has had these discussions, and there was a push earlier to make the grading that was just discussed this week more rigorous, but enough board members kind of retreated from that stance. They didn't want to shake up the apple cart too much this year. And I think, frankly, I think what they did makes sense this year, because last year was the first year of the new test. There were all kinds of problems in terms of administering the test.
Right,
with
some
the technology.
Computer glitches and whatnot, right? So it sort of didn't go too well.
Yeah, and so, and now, as you know, I mean, we usually get these scores and school grades back in the fall, and here we are in January still talking about what the cut scores are. So, again, the whole point of accountability is to find out where there may be problems and address those problems. Well, we're already halfway through the school year, more than halfway through the school year. So that's not doing students or teachers much good this year at all.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think they really just need to focus on the, you know, not focus so much on this year's kind of a year because of the transition to the new test, but they really just need to focus, you know, on the future and down the road.
1-866-338-5252. Is the future looking good as far as students are taking those tests here in Florida? There's still some more kind of fine-tuning to be done. 1-866-338-5252. Jason Garcia, moving to the politics of the thing, the governor, as we've talked about, is very focused on jobs. So any strategy that can get graduating students more job-ready would seem like a good fit with that. But testing's also kind of unpopular in some circles politically. So is the governor walking a bit of a tightrope here?
Yeah, this is a difficult issue for him, although it's an interesting one, and it's one of the clearest examples where you see him sort of sticking with his sort of Republican Tea Party base more than the business lobby who he's normally hand in glove with at this point.
Mm-hmm.
The governor has very clearly and this is also, by the way, one of the clearest signs of divide between Jeb Bush and Rick Scott. The governor has very clearly sided with the folks who think there is too much testing, who think he has been very supportive of easing up on standards, all things that generally Jeb Bush and the business lobby oppose.
Right.
But it is a difficult issue for him because you're right. I mean, businesses want to make sure kids are prepared, like Beth said. And as you start to back away from that and as you start to sort of allow different measuring sticks to be used by different agencies or different locations, it becomes harder and harder to say if kids really are learning before they graduate.
Mm-hmm. Frank Torres, Central Florida has a pretty active and vocal opt-out movement, as do other parts of the state when it comes to high school testing in other school areas too. What are you anticipating from those folks in reaction to what the State Board of Education decided on this week, the new measures for assessment?
I think reaction is the main word. I think they're going to move into this year and wait for the next wave. And if there continues to be difficulties, then you're going to see even more anger. As Beth mentioned, there was an initiative out there in Seminole County to reform the process and to get different things up and going. But you know, we're still seeing teachers having to dedicate most of their time for testing, still having problems with the automation involved, and the conditions themselves are very bad. You've got, you know, more than enough students crammed into a gymnasium or other, you know, makeshift testing
right.
environments to try to make these things happen. So, I mean, parents will continue to be wary, but if there's another incident, then I think we're going to see some real anger there.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move on to a bit of local and state politics and talk about some of the local races here. In Central Florida, State Senate District 13, former State Rep Linda Stewart is running to replace Andy Gardner, joining the race with Mike Cleland and Rick Roach, and that's on the Democratic Party side. The GOP race includes Realtor Dean Asher, a fairly well-known name there. Frank Torres, Linda Stewart is quite well-known in political circles here in Central Florida. What can you tell us about her opponents, though, Rick Roach and Mike Cleland?
Yeah, as you recall, Linda Stewart, well-known, two-time county commissioner, former state representative. Mike Cleland actually pulled off one of the biggest political upsets in recent history by winning, he's a Democrat, winning in a heavily Republican seat that was made for the would-be House Speaker. And he really shocked the political landscape here. So what we have here is a matchup between Cullen and Linda Stewart, two underdogs. Linda Stewart has also won on unfriendly turf,
mm-hmm.
Going against each other in what is going to be a really intriguing primary. And you've also got Rick Roach, who's been running in the contest for the last 18 months, but hasn't failed to gain any traction. It's going to be really tough for him to stand a conversation.
Mm-hmm. Jason, what do you think about when you see this? I mean, it looks a little bit like another congressional race in Central Florida. It's pitting some fairly high-profile Democrats against each other. Is this a good thing for the party?
Generally speaking, yeah, I think so. The Democratic primary for this Senate seat is going to be the most interesting local race on the ballot, certainly in the primaries, because you've got a really interesting contrast here. As Frank said, Linda Stewart is someone who's really well known in the community. She's very popular with sort of the Democratic base. But Mike Cleland is a guy who Democratic Party leaders in Tallahassee have been thinking for a long time now could be a future star for them. A lot of people think this is a guy who might be an attorney general candidate one day for the state party. So mm-hmm. I think you're going to see a lot of outside Democratic interest groups getting involved in that race. Particularly, I think there'll be a big push to help Mike Cleland win that seat because to sort of set him up for a future run. It's going to be a really interesting race. What you're seeing here, what's drawing this is That seat now has been redrawn. This was historically a Republican seat, but it has now become a Democratic seat. I think Barack Obama won 56% of the vote in that seat in 2012. So we've created a new Senate seat, a very attractive state Senate seat that is very likely to favor a Democratic candidate. So you're starting to draw a lot of the stronger Democratic candidates are interested in this because this is an opportunity that wasn't there before.
So this is part of the what went on last year with redistricting, the kind of redistricting mess that we went through with the congressional and then with state Senate races, new maps, so kind of a fresh start for some of these districts.
Yeah, that's right. This the original version of this district went all the way over to Brevard County, and it took in some really Republican areas in Brevard County, which helped make it a more Republican-leaning seat. That's gone from this district now, and in its place are places like Azalea Park and other places in East Orange County or Southeast Orange County that are much more friendly to Democrats, and that has sort of completely shifted the dynamics of this seat.
Mm-hmm. Well, moving on from politics to tourism, Visit Orlando says after a huge year for tourism in 2015, don't expect the same kind of hot growth this year. Visit Orlando CEO George Agel says growth could cool down a bit. 62 million people visited Orlando in 2014. The numbers haven't quite been fully tabulated yet, but 2015 is expected to surpass that. Jason Garcia, should the tourism industry here in Central Florida be worried if growth isn't quite so hot?
No, not particularly. You're not going to set a record every single year. Generally, the trajectory is up, and there's a lot of reasons to be optimistic on the horizon, particularly from Orlando tourism. You know, Disney is at some point, I presume, is finally going to open Avatar Land. They've committed to
Avatar Land?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. The Avatar Land they're building in the Animal Kingdom that feels like they've been building it for about 20 years.
I mean, that movie was pretty huge when it came out.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. When it came out, what was it, 2008 or 6 or 10 or something like that? Yeah. And then Disney has also they've begun working on plans for a Star Wars Land, and I believe there's a Toy Story Land coming. Universal, Comcast is sinking more money into theme parks than we've seen anyone do since the Disney decade in the 90s. So there's going to be a lot of stuff coming in online over the next 10 years or so that, a year-to-year slowdown is probably not worth worrying about.
Mm-hmm. Frank Torres, there's a political component to this, as many stories. More tourists equals more tourist development tax dollars. Do you ever hear anything, though, other than cheerleading from elected officials about tourism numbers going up?
No, you don't, but the trend backs up the talk this time. You know, politicians are prone to the hype, but the numbers are there. And there are so many attractions coming in the next couple of years. We could do a whole show probably on that. Don't forget about Skyplex, the world's largest roller coaster. Tourism really is something to be proud of in the region. Of course, where that TDT goes, that's another – the tourism development tax dollars, that's another battle altogether. Who gets that share of the money for whatever projects? I think that's a very interesting angle. But I think Visit Orlando is being – a little bearish on purpose, trying to lower expectations. The tourism industry is doing wonderful. Traffic in and out of Orlando International has been going really well, especially international traffic. I think we'll be just fine.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to finally talk about something that's pretty well known to Seminole County residents, and Oviedo locals will know this iconic townhouse restaurant. It's a yellow building that's synonymous with Oviedo. It's been there for some 50 years, and it's kind of part of the city as much as chickens. It's going to be torn down, though. It's moving to a brand new building just a block or so away. Full disclosure, I sometimes bike past this. I've been sort of watching this new building go up over the last year or so, and it's interesting to see how that's progressing. Beth Kassab, this is kind of more than just a story about an old restaurant, though, right? It's like a reflection of how Oviedo is changing. And, you know, what does it tell you about the demographics of Oviedo and just the change that you're seeing in that town?
Well, look, Oviedo is kind of going through a huge growth spurt right now. I've got a pretty good seat to watch that because I happen to live in Oviedo, and the townhouse is a great place. Locals love it. It's an awesome spot for breakfast, or they serve lunch and dinner too. You know, it's sort of a traditional diner. The new place is larger and very bright and new and sterile, and it has a completely different vibe than the old place, which was small and very homey and cozy.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is representative of what's going on in Oviedo. Oviedo, you know, this is kind of the same story that we've seen in Winter Garden and other places all around Central Florida. Used to be very heavily agriculture, citrus, and celery. And now what you've got out here is suburban growth. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people love the Seminole Trails, like you mentioned going by there. I mean, that's extremely popular. Our family enjoys that as well.
Right.
The new townhouse happens to be right on the trail, and they've even got patio seating now, so you can, you know, sit back on the patio and watch people go by. You know, so that's generally a good thing for Oviedo residents. But downtown Oviedo, and as I said in my column earlier this week, you know, downtown's kind of a generous term. It's very, right. very small. But, you know, huge changes there. They're leveling these old buildings. Things mm-hmm. are going to be new. And, you know, to me, there's something very sad about that. As much as this area is resigned to progress, it's sad to lose the old stuff. You lose the feel, and you lose a little bit of history.
Beth Kassab is a columnist with the Orlando Sentinel. Thank you so much for joining us, Beth.
Thank you.
Jason Garcia, associate editor with Florida Trend magazine. Thanks for stopping by, Jason.
Yeah, it was fun. Thanks for having me.
And Frank Torres, editor of the Orlando Political Observer. Thanks as always, Frank.
Anytime.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. The producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Production assistance this week from Nicole Christen, Amy Green, and Alex Gasparini. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.